Hi, my name's Ilanka. I'm going to be speaking about famous unsolved codes. And how many people here were at my talk yesterday on cryptos? Okay. There will be several slides in here that will be kind of a repeat of that because I definitely have to include cryptos as one of the world's most famous unsolved codes. So I wanted to apologize for, hey, she talked about that yesterday. Also, is anyone here a cryptographer or a code cracker, or have you worked on any codes that you consider to be famous unsolved codes? Just kind of see, because sometimes I say, come on up. What codes have you worked on?
Well, all I did was some programming that wrote a secret encrypted code string with some licensing software.
Okay.
And I called it the super secret encrypted code string. And my boss looks in and says, the sex.
Super.
S-E-C-S.
Okay.
And it's the sex. So from then on, it was referred to as the sex.
All right.
The sex string.
Wasn't Unix sort of named after something sexual,
No?
I thought it had something to do with like E-U-N-U-C-H-S and going after Multics.
It actually came after Multics.
Right. Okay. Anyway. Okay. That's moving right along. Okay. So I'm going to explain a little bit about who I am and how I got into cryptography. And I'm going to go over several very specific unsolved codes, and also some unsolved codes that were unsolved until they were solved. And I'll talk a little bit about what it is that they say and how those were cracked. And then a large section of the talk is going to be about cryptos, since that's the one that's near and dear to my heart. So my day job is that I'm a game developer. I make games, or my company makes games for the internet at play.net. We've been doing this for many, many years, and we have some of the longest-running commercial multiplayer games in the world. And I've also been involved with computers forever. My father was involved with computers back in the days when they were these large room-sized things where if the computer crashed, you needed to reboot it by re-entering the operating system by hand in binary, by flipping the little switches or pushing the little buttons. And so he used to take me in to work with him. My dad worked for Hughes Aircraft. He was on the team that launched the very first geosynchronous communication satellite. I loved playing with the chads. I mean, that was as a little kid. I'd go to the key punch machines and I'd pull out that little tray underneath the key punch machine, just handfuls of confetti that I'd be throwing all over the computer room. So, yeah, the janitor staff really, really liked me. And I've also been a speaker at several different conventions. That's actually Dragon Con right here is how I got into cryptography, at least in the public scene. I've been into puzzles since I was a little kid. My mother tells stories about even before I could walk, about how if I was fussing or something, she'd put me on the back doorstep with a jigsaw puzzle, and I would just be sitting there playing for hours. And then there was when I was a little older, there was a neighborhood boy who was studying for a merit badge or on something, and he had books on codes, and I was just over at his house all the time, just totally obsessed, asking him questions and driving him crazy, and he finally just gave me all of his books to get me away. And I didn't get into the public scene until about 5 years ago. I was actually here at Dragon Con speaking about computer games. And through the Electronic Frontiers track here, and I would meet some of the speakers at the other sessions here in the track, and some of the other speakers were the hackers, and they'd come in and they'd speak about computer security and whatnot, and so we'd get drunk at the end of the day, and they told me about a code that had been released at a hacker convention called the Freaknik 3 code, and it was a code that had been released as a challenge to the attendees of the convention. And it had been a year, and no one had cracked it yet. And so after Dragon Con, I took the flyer with the code, and then I went home, and then I was, like, really bored. I think I was homesick with the flu or something, and I was just kind of rattling around stir-crazy. And so I picked up the code, and I decided to take a look at it. And then I just got totally obsessed, and I couldn't put the thing down. And I became completely antisocial. Like, if any of my friends IM'd me, I was like, don't talk to me unless you want to talk about codes. And I cracked the code. It took 10 days, but I figured it out, and I won a free trip to the Freaknik convention and free hotel and drinks and T-shirts and whatnot. And then I went around cracking a bunch of other codes. And I cracked so many that I've actually been banned from competition at some conventions. Like the AtlantiCon code, when they released their flyer, at the bottom of the flyer it said, note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the AtlantiCon puzzle. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka. So I cracked that one too, and Johnny X wrote really rude things about me on the little light board that he had down in the lobby of the convention. And then September 11th happened, and I wanted to know if maybe I could use my cryptography skills to help out with the war on terrorism. And so I called up the local FBI, and I asked them if I could help, and they said no, and I kept calling them back. And then finally I got an agent who asked me, well, what is it that you know about? And I said, I listed off all the different code systems. And one of the ones I mentioned was one called steganography. And he said, wow, you know, we've been hearing rumors that Al-Qaeda may have been using steganography as a way to plan the September 11th attack. And there's probably people in Washington, D.C., in the main FBI office that know all about these forms of codes, but we don't know that much about it here in the St. Louis field office. We have a different mission, like, you know, taking crime reports and dealing with bank robberies and whatnot. And so he said, maybe you could come in and kind of give a talk about what steganography is. And I said, sure. And they thought I was going to put together a little 10-minute talk, and I put together this huge 70-slide PowerPoint presentation, and I researched all kinds of open source stuff about what kind of codes that Al-Qaeda was using. And I don't believe that they were using steganography, but the kinds of codes that they were using were usually very simplistic stuff. Like if they were talking on a cell phone and they needed to say FBI, instead of saying FBI, they would say food and beverage industry. There was a really bizarre plot that they had to cut cables on a suspension bridge with gas cutters. And it wouldn't have worked, even if they would have tried it. But the instructions that they were given is that if they were to talk about it on the phone, that they should never say gas cutter on the phone, that they should say gas station. So they were trying to fool some of the pattern matching things. For the September 11th attack, they had code words for various of the targets. So the Mohammed Atta, who was the cell member in the United States, he had another cell member back in Hamburg, Germany, who was Ramzi Bin al-Shib. And what Atta and Bin al-Shib would do is they would talk on the internet, and they would pretend to be a boyfriend and a girlfriend discussing school plans. And then they would have code words for some of the things that they were doing. For example, they would if they were talking about the Trade Center, they would call it the Faculty of Town Planning. And the code name for the Pentagon was the Faculty of Fine Arts. And they would say things like, the end of the semester is fast approaching, we have 19 certificates of completion. And that meant, you know, we're getting ready to attack, and we have 19 hijackers ready to go. And this was all, and this is firsthand from Bin al-Shib, who gave an interview to Al Jazeera 1 year after the attacks. And I went and I tracked that down, and I tracked down English translations of the interview that he gave where he was describing what he'd done. But anyway, I'm getting way off the track here. I'm very hungover at the moment, so I apologize. Also after September 11th, I organized a Simutronics Crisis Center because many of my customers were affected by the events of September 11th. And so I put together a database where we were tracking down the status of every single one of my customers that I knew about in New York and Washington, D.C. area. And one of the sidetrack things I did there is one of my customers did something really, really, really scummy, is that he used September 11th as an opportunity to declare himself dead, and then was going around online pretending to be his own widow just so he could kind of traumatize his friends. And he was involved in this really nasty thing with his wife, and he was kind of unstable. But I was the one that figured that out and tracked him down and got him to post a formal confession about what he'd done, and then a formal apology to the community. And there's several newspaper articles about that. If you go to Ilanka.com, you can read more about all that. The Cyrillic projector cipher is one of the things that I'm going to be talking about. I put together a team that cracked that code. It had been uncracked for several years. And while I was working on some of these big famous codes, people kept asking me, well, how famous is this code, and how famous is that code, and what are the 10 most famous unsolved codes? And there really wasn't any formal definitive list, so I said, okay, I'll make a list of famous unsolved codes. And I wrote to cryptographers all over the world, and the head of American Cryptogram Association, and the staff of various cryptography magazines, and put together this big list. And it was just kind of a one-page thing that I did to have a reference on my site, famous unsolved codes. And all of a sudden, it's like a blogosphere darling, and I'm getting tens of thousands of people from all over the world that are coming to my site because I'm saying, wow, this is really cool. I'm like, okay. And it's really amazing that I've got this one page of text that has no graphics on it whatsoever, that's had just literally tens of thousands of visitors. So I evidently tickled something in the global meme there. And another on the last bullet point there about the Cryptos discussion group, I made a webpage about Cryptos, which again was just a single webpage. And it became kind of crypto central on the web, and I started corresponding with a lot of really interesting people. And one of the people who contacted me was a man named Gary Warzen, who had some very interesting theories about cryptos. He'd really done a lot of work on the sculpture. It was one of his life's hobbies. And he and I founded a discussion group on Yahoo Groups to talk about cryptos, and I'll have pictures of what cryptos is. And we've had several hundred members of the group now, and it's a little bit sad for me because Gary just passed away last weekend. So I'm looking at the slide, and I'm seeing co-moderator, and I guess I'm going to have to change that. So I'll dedicate this talk to Gary. So the Freaknik 3 code, this is the code that I heard about here at DragonCon. And I can do a whole nother talk about how this thing is all put together, and it's kind of take apart like an onion. But it uses several different kinds of cryptographic systems. It uses PGP and binary and hexadecimal, and UU encoding and ROT13. And it's when I first started working on it, I actually didn't know that much about many of these systems, and I love learning new things. And I would. People ask me, how do you solve these codes? And I say, well, I take the code, and first I just stare at it for a long time, and I see if anything jumps out at me. And I work at anything that I kind of understand. And then I go around, and I show it to the smartest people I know, and I kind of hang over them and say, what do you see? What do you see? What do you see? And I kind of listen to them. And once those are like the two easy things to do, and then I have to kind of kick in and start doing some more serious research. And when I get really stuck, I'll go back to talking to other people about it. It's definitely not something that I do in... on a solo basis. I'll talk to little kids. I've gotten ideas for cracking a code because a little kid will look at it and they'll just have a completely fresh pair of eyes that are looking at something, and they'll say, oh, it looks like a staircase. And I'll go, oh my God, I hadn't even thought of that. And then maybe it'll be something that cracks it open, and maybe it won't. But the point is, when working on one of these codes, reach out for as many different sources of information as you can. After I cracked the Freaknik 3 code, I wrote this tutorial about how I'd done it and put it again on a web page. And it's written in a very tongue-in-cheek cyberpunk fashion. There's lots of little in-jokes that are hidden all through there. So if anybody really likes looking for hidden stuff, there's references to The Matrix and Illuminatus and Monty Python and all kinds of little things hidden in there. So while working on the Freaknik 3 code, I learned about the crypto sculpture. And this was a dead end as part of the Freaknik 3 code. This is a sculpture that's at the center of CIA headquarters. It's about 12 feet high, if you count that petrified log on the side, and it's about 20 feet long. There's letters that are actually punched through it. So we're looking through it, and we're seeing the other side of the sculpture. There are at least four codes that are on this sculpture. Three of them, we know what they say. The fourth one, we do not know what it says yet. It's 97 or 98 characters down at the very bottom of the left-hand side, and I'll have some other slides on it. And it is one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. So people would ask me, how famous is Kryptos? And in the list that I put together, I list Kryptos at about number five. In this talk, I'll be going over definitely the top five, and I'll kind of spot check others on the list. Is there any code in particular here that anyone here in the audience like really wants to hear about that you'd be disappointed if you walked away and I didn't talk about it? Anybody in the back? Have I messed with Johnny X's DNA code? Yes, there are a couple different ones. The very first one I did solve. It wasn't just me; it was me and a guy named Honey, who was at the Freaknik convention at that time. When I go to the conventions and Johnny X has one of these new codes, and he hands out the code, and I take the flyer, and everybody is saying, hey, you're going to solve the code, you're going to solve the code. And I'm like, I don't want to spend the entire weekend doing nothing but working on the code. It gets in the way of my drinking. And So the DNA code, I didn't work on it during the convention, but then Honey and I cracked it the day after the convention. I think there's a second DNA code, and I've sort of looked at it, but I haven't really played with it seriously. Yes, I will have a little bit about Linear A and a little bit on Linear B. Any others that somebody really wants? Yeah, red shirt, yeah?
The really old ones are interesting. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I've got anything I don't go over, you can definitely go to my website, ilanka.com, and I've got links to more information on all this from there. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, and this is, again, just a real simple web page that has gotten very popular on the web. So one of them is this is a real simple one. This is the Dorabella cipher. And this is the composer Edward Elgar wrote that. He wrote the music, The Pomp and Circumstance, the da-da-da-da-da, you know, that you hear in a graduation ceremony. Yeah. And he was interested in codes, and he actually encoded some stuff into some of his music. It was called the Enigma Variations. And he had a young friend. She was like the daughter of one of his other friends, or a daughter or a niece. And she was 22 years old, Dora Penny. And she didn't know codes. So she wasn't like this super brilliant cryptographic genius. And at one point, Elgar wrote a letter. I believe it was either to Dora's mother or aunt or something. And on the back of it, or on the envelope, he wrote this little code. And it was like an extra message to Dora. And Dora was not able to solve it, but she was like a member of society, and much later in her life she wrote her memoirs, and as part of her memoirs she said, and here's this code, and I would most appreciate if anyone could tell me what it says. And to this day, no one has cracked this code. And it looks like it would be like a simple substitution cipher. We have no idea. There's been lots of theories about maybe it has something to do, maybe it's not substitution, maybe there's a musical base to it. People have looked at the way the symbols are kind of rotated in different directions. Dora once asked him at one point what it said, and his comment to her was something to the effect of, with all that we've talked about, I'm surprised that you haven't solved it. So maybe there was like a secret keyword that they had between them. No idea. I mean, they're both passed away at this point. And just one of those intriguing things. And then there's the Zodiac ciphers. So this is a very different kind of theme. There was a serial killer in the late 1960s, early 1970s that was going around really terrorizing the West Coast. I think it was California. Does anybody remember offhand where it was? Northern California. And he would leave these messages, and he would kind of taunt the police and say, if you can solve this, it gives information about who I am and how you can find me. So many of the messages were cracked. A few of them never have been cracked, and the killer was never caught. Now, more recently in the news, we have the BTK killer. Some of you may have heard something about this, and he also had codes. And I was kind of intrigued about that. And then what I found out is that when he originally did the original killing, he never used encoded messages, but he seemed to be kind of obsessed with getting famous, and he would try and copy techniques of other famous serial killers. And then he kind of went underground for a long time, and then when he resurfaced, ta-da, he had these codes, because I think he was, again, trying to emulate the Zodiac killer, and I think those codes kind of helped put the nail in his coffin, because he was desired to get famous, and so he had these codes that gave information about him. And so I don't include the BTK killer's stuff on the famous unsolved codes, but the Zodiac killer definitely counts. And there's a website called ZodiacKiller.com that has transcripts of all the messages that have been solved and the ones that have not yet been solved, so if anybody wants to try their hand at them. Okay, the Beale ciphers is the number one on my list. And it's, some people say it shouldn't be, was the question?
Why are some not solved, and once you figure out what he was doing, why couldn't you solve the other?
Okay, the question is, why are some of the Zodiac killer messages solved and why are some unsolved? Well, he used different systems. So if we have one message that is decrypted, he also had a lot of spelling errors throughout. I don't know if you can see in the one that we have here. I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest. And it was just, even that's one thing that I think makes some of the unsolved codes unsolvable, is because someone probably screwed up when they were encrypting them. Every single code that I have cracked, every single one, and I'm talking about the big ones and I'm talking about the little ones, I mean the hacker challenges, every single one of them has had mistakes. Sometimes those mistakes may be put in there because the code writer is trying to be clever, but most of the time I think it's just humans are making these codes, and they're very complex things to do, and it's difficult enough for someone to just write a plain English letter without without any typos in it. Imagine if you're trying to encrypt things and the amount of detail involved. I get teenagers contacting me probably about sometimes once a week, sometimes once a month, and they go, hey, I've got this code, can you crack this code? And the first thing I'll usually ask them is, has anyone else tested this code beside yourself? Because often they encrypt something and they can't even decrypt the thing that they just created, because they just kind of put it together. Or one kid, what he did is he went to one of the online encryption utility web pages, and he fed in a bunch of text, and it had letters and spaces and punctuation marks and numbers. Well, he got this output, but that particular utility only took alphabetic characters. It couldn't handle numbers and spaces and punctuation. So he put in text, he got complete garbage out that no one could have decrypted unless you went in and really took apart the algorithm of that particular utility. And it's something that I find very irritating, is people who encrypt things and then don't even bother testing them to make sure that they're decryptable. Sorry, that's my little rant. Did that kind of answer your question about the Zodiac Killer? Okay. All right. So the Beale ciphers. All right. Some people say that this should not be an unsolved code because they think that it was a hoax, but I will tell you what is known about it. In 1885, a pamphlet was offered for sale in Bedford, Virginia. And in the pamphlet, it said, I have worked on these codes. These codes were given to me by an innkeeper. They were given to the innkeeper by this other man from many decades ago. And the first man showed up with these wagons full of evidently gold and jewels at Bedford, and then he left some encrypted messages with the innkeeper saying, if I never return, take a look at these messages. And the guy never returned, and the innkeeper, according to the story, the innkeeper examined the messages, couldn't do anything, and at the end of the innkeeper's life, he passed the messages along to the author of this pamphlet. And the author of the pamphlet says that he worked for many, many years on the codes, on the three messages, and he solved one of them, and it used the key of the Declaration of Independence. But he could never solve the other two messages, and since it was consuming his life, that he decided he would publish everything he knew about it in the pamphlet, which was being offered for sale at a very modest price, and that he was going to walk away from it at that point. Supposedly, the one message that was decrypted details exactly what was buried. And this is an example of the first of the message, which supposedly gives the exact location of the gold and gems that were buried. This is one of the messages that has not been cracked. It's a series of numbers. And this is the message that was cracked, again, a series of numbers, and I'll go into how this comes apart into a message. And then so here we've got those numbers along the top line here. So we have 115, 73, 24, 807, 37. If you take the Declaration of Independence and you take each word and you number it, so when in the course of human events, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, then you look for like the 115th word is the word instituted. You take the first letter of that word, which is I. Okay. Then you take the 73rd word, which is hold, and you take the first letter, which is H. And you go on to the 24th word, which is another, and you take the first letter, which is A. So you have I-H-A-V, I have. And you keep doing that through all the different numbers, and you get a message. And I believe I have. And it says, I have deposited in the county of Bedford, about 4 miles from Buford's, in an excavation or vault, 6 feet below the surface of the ground, the following articles belonging jointly to the parties whose names are given in number 3 herewith. The first deposit consisted of 1,014 pounds of gold and 3,812 pounds of silver, deposited November 1819. The second was made December 1821 and consisted of 1,907 pounds of gold and 1,288 pounds of silver, also jewels obtained in St. Louis in exchange for silver to save transportation and valued at $13,000. The above is securely packed in iron pots with iron covers. The vault is roughly lined with stone, and the vessels rest on solid stone and are covered with others. Paper number 1 describes the exact locality of the vault so that no difficulty will be had in finding it.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a very intriguing message here. And over the last more than 100 years, many, many holes have been dug in this countryside all around Bedford, Virginia. There have been many very well-financed expeditions that have gone in digging everywhere. Nothing's been found. Many people have popped up saying that they have cracked some of these codes, and usually because this is in conjunction with a book that they're trying to sell. And I've acquired a couple of these books, and I look at it, and nowhere in there is there any kind of a duplicatable decryption method. They just say they've cracked the code and what they think it says, but nowhere do they say, okay, well, you take this number and it goes to this letter. One man, Jim Gologli, who was the ex-head of the American Cryptogram Association, he ran some frequency analysis on one of the messages with all the numbers. And what he found is that if you applied it to, I believe, the Declaration of Independence or another document, you don't get anything like recognizable plain text, but at one point you do get the entire alphabet in order, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M. So his theory is that this entire thing was a hoax. It was a plot, an urban legend designed simply to sell pamphlets. And that whoever was encrypting these messages got really bored while they were writing down all the numbers, and so they decided to just kind of do the alphabet or do something else. And I think that's a very plausible theory. But other people say, no, that's just an artifact, and it's actually encrypted with multiple different methods. And so by finding the alphabet, you know you've figured out the first method, and there's actually another method after that that needs to be figured out. So I still have it on my list of famous unsolved codes, but there's a pretty good run for the money saying that it's not ever going to be solvable. And this is a paper number 3 that supposedly has the names and residences. And that's one of the things that kind of jumps out at me is that, okay, I can see why you'd want to encrypt what was buried and you'd want to encrypt where it was buried, but why would you want to encrypt who it belongs to? It's kind of an odd thing. Also, in the pamphlet, there were some things saying, okay, and we received a letter from the man who supposedly had the gold, and he and his friends, they found these mines in the southwestern United States, and then they got separated because there was a stampede. And somebody did some research saying, you know, the word stampede really wasn't in use around that year. It really didn't come into use until a few decades after that. So, which might put some questions on it or might not, because maybe the word stampede was in use and it just hadn't been documented yet. So, lots of different speculation. And also just the whole story. Okay, somebody got gold in like Arizona, New Mexico, 3 wagons full, him and his buddies, and then his buddies all stayed there, and this one guy takes all this gold all the way back to Virginia to bury it, and then leaves the and it just it doesn't pass the sniff test. It's yeah. So and there's no other independent sources of information on it. Everything about it that's known comes from this one pamphlet. So now some people say that perhaps whoever wrote the pamphlet was a Mason, and the Masons have a philosophy which is that what's important is the constant quest for information, that the quest is more important than what you're actually learning. And I won't actually read this entire fable here, but basically it's about a farmer and his sons, and a farmer was worried about that his sons would not prosper after his death, so he told them that he had buried gold out in the vineyard. And then the sons spent all their time digging in the vineyard looking for that gold, and they never found it, but by the act of the digging, the vineyard prospered, and so the entire family prospered. So it's the act of seeking. And I can definitely identify with that in terms of the codes I've been working on. And I think David Allen Wilson, who's a member of our cryptography group, had a really interesting quote where he said, whether or not we solve cryptos, it doesn't really matter. I have learned so much just by working on cryptos that I have gained a great deal in my life from it. So. Okay, here's another interesting one, the money pit, Oak Island. So a teenager was walking along in 1795 in this island off the coast of Nova Scotia, and he ran across this pit, and this is verified. And there was kind of a depression in the ground, and there was a tree over it with this big branch, and there was like a block and tackle hanging over this depression. It looked very intriguing. Why was there this big, you know, pulley system over this depression in the ground? So later on, the kid comes back with some of his other friends, and they start digging, and they dig down the depression. They get down about 10 feet, and they find this barrier of logs. And like, okay, and they get through the barrier, and then they dig down another 10 feet, and they find another barrier of some palm fronds or something. They dig down, and they keep digging, and they keep running into man-made artifacts in this pit. Now, eventually, this island, it's very, very low. It's very, very close to sea level. And so they dig down to a certain point, and the pit starts flooding with water, and they can't get any further. So they return periodically, and they'd get down so far, and then the pit would start flooding with water again. And over the last, well, we have over 200 years now, most of the big chunk of the island is basically gone. I mean, there's heavy machinery that's really just kind of, you know, raped that part of the island. And they've dug down as far as they can, and they've run into several more barriers, but wondering what's at the bottom of this pit, because it keeps flooding. and this is kind of a chart and showing. Hey, you can see there was the tree with the block and tackle, and there were some stones, and then there was an oak platform, another oak platform, and then they ran into sea level, okay, and then they ran into a putty and charcoal oak platform, and there have been various expeditions that have tried lowering a camera down in there to see, and every so often they'll say, we saw something that looked like a chest, or when we were drilling down there, we got something, and there were little shavings of metal. Maybe there's a chest full of gold pieces down there. And other people have said, no, you probably ran into, the bit was probably coming apart, and that's where you got the shavings of metal. And so it's still a big mystery. Now, doing all this digging cost a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money has been spent trying to find what's at the bottom of this pit. And there would be lots of fundraising drives saying, you know, help, give us money so that we can go and we can keep digging and you'll get all your money back because there will be a lot of treasure at the bottom. And during one of these fundraising drives, a stone was found that had this encrypted message on it, a code. And it's actually a substitution cipher, and it says 40 feet below, 2 million pounds are buried. So some people say that maybe this is a clue that maybe there really is money down there, and somebody else says, no, this is a stone that was planted there as a way to get the the investors to dig a little more into their pockets. And I'm more inclined to think the second, because it's an English language straight, simple substitution cipher. There's no record of this particular kind of system being used anywhere else. But still, the stories go, well, maybe the Knights Templar buried the Holy Grail there. It's just something that really, that humans just love hearing stories like this, the unknown, what's buried down there. Right. So here's another interesting famous unsolved code called the Voynich Manuscript. It's something that surfaced a few hundred years ago, at least 400 years old, and it's 232 pages long. It's written in no language that is recognized, with no script that is recognized, but it's beautifully drawn, and there's beautiful charts all through it, and it's not just slapped together. Somebody carefully used calligraphy for over 230 pages writing in this bizarre script. Did aliens come down and give some language? There's little pictures in there sometimes of people, and there's pictures of plants that are all mythical plants, that none of these plants actually exist. Track it back. We know that in the 16th century it belonged to Emperor Rudolf, because he shelled out some big gold ducats. He shelled out big ducats for it, roughly $30,000 in today's money. And then it kind of faded out of sight, and then an antique book dealer tracked it and discovered it again. So it's possible that, again, this is sort of a hoax. Emperor Rudolf had a reputation for shelling out big gold for interesting curiosities. So there's a possibility that a team went out to make this really interesting, beautiful curiosity to get the gold out of the emperor. Or it may be something that's solvable. There was something that showed up on Slashdot, I think, last year, and also in Scientific American, and this is a theory for how it may have been created if it was a hoax, is that someone used a card and grill system, which is that they may have had this huge chart with lots of different syllables, and that they kind of moved these grids around, and wherever the holes in the grid pointed to these syllables, they might have used those as kind of the template, and then they would write things out from there. It's a plausible theory. However, at this point, no one has been able to duplicate this to recreate any single section of the manuscript. It's plausible but unproven. All right. So now here's another famous unsolved code. This is Edgar Allan Poe, was quite famous as a code cracker, and he did a regular column in a literary publication, literary newsletter, and he would tell people, send me any kind of code that is a single substitution cipher, and I will crack it. Now, anyone who's played with cryptography knows that a single substitution cipher is really trivial to crack. It's very, very easy, and anybody can do it in a few minutes. But people kept sending him these single substitution ciphers. It's just straight one letter for another letter, and he would crack them, and they'd go, Edgar Allan Poe, he's a genius. Eventually, all good things had to come to an end, though, and he had to stop writing the column. And so in his last, in the last edition of the column, he said, okay, here, for your as a challenge for you, are two challenge ciphers, something to keep you busy. So these were published in the mid-1800s, and no one solved them. No one solved them until in 1992, and I think it was probably because of the internet and people were able to get their hands on these things. 1992, someone cracked one of them, and then in 2000, someone cracked the other. I think one of the reasons they took so long is because of the non-standard alphabets that they used. You can see this one where someone used a typewriter for it, but some of the letters are upside down and uppercase and lowercase. And small caps, all kinds of different font things. And it comes out to be quotes from various plays. The other one, again, here, we have different punctuation symbols. The way that this particular one was cracked was, you see right here these three symbols where there's like a comma and a dagger and kind of a section mark. And again, we hear the comma, the dagger, and the section mark. And that kind of the comma, dagger, section mark. And someone made the speculation that maybe that three-letter grouping is the most common three-letter word in the English language, which is the. Very good, right? Yeah. And so they started from there, and sure enough, and it starts off, the soul secure in existence, so T-H-E.
But it's written backwards.
And it's written backwards?
It's like the soul secure. It's written backwards.
Okay. I'll have to take a closer look at it. Somebody, John Wilson, is saying that it's written backwards, so I'll have to. Okay. This one is the other cipher, and this one used a much more complex system. This used a polyalphabetic substitution cipher, so multiple alphabets that were used. And when this one was solved, and the first one as well, there were many spelling errors in there. I kind of posted one that didn't have the errors, but this one, I included some of them for like Esern, which they thought meant essence, and as the clusterous ringlets were edged by amorous and sportive zephyrs, and when he perceived the rude intrusion of the sunlight. So again, it's something, a very error-prone process, making these codes. Right. Okay, now we're going on to another one, which is the Phaistos disk. This one is really old, and this one is actually tied into Linear A and Linear B. In many tablets with various inscriptions that are about 2,000 to 3,000 years old were discovered in the neighborhood of Greece. And one of them we've solved, and that was Linear B. And then Linear A is another language that has not yet been solved. This disk is several inches across and may turn out to be something like a Rosetta Stone that helps with the solving of Linear A. It's got many symbols that are stamped into it on both sides. And we don't know what it says yet. Oops, I clicked on the wrong thing, and it's going to try and open my web browser now. I apologize for that. Now, there are definitely several websites of people who say that they've solved it. Someone can go in and they can kind of claim anything that they want, usually, again, because they're trying to sell a book where they have information about, and here, read my method. So it's about 6 inches across. It was discovered in the early 1900s. It's believed to date back to 1800 BC. So it has an alphabet of 45 different symbols that are used over and over again, but we have no idea what it says. Okay, then there's Kryptos, one of my favorites here. This is a sculpture at the NCIA headquarters, and it's got a visionaire table on one side and a cipher alphabet. It was designed by James Sanborn. He's a sculptor in Washington, D.C. He was born in 1945. And he, when the CIA commissioned their new headquarters building, they put out the call to various artists saying, we would like some art to go with the building. And Sanborn had done many large public art projects. And so he spoke up and said, hey, I'd like to do the art. And he knew the whole process of submitting the various bids for it. And he got the bid. And then he decided, after he got it, he did some more research on the CIA and decided that he wanted to do something with the theme of cryptography. And so he was teamed with a man named Ed Scheidt, who was a retiring CIA operative. And Ed was called the Wizard of Codes by William Webster. And Ed taught Sanborn about how to make certain codes. And then Sanborn took what he had learned from Ed Scheidt, and he created the crypto sculpture with the four codes on the sculpture. Three of those four have been solved. This is Jim Galoglu, who I've mentioned a couple times. He was the first person to publicly solve the first three parts of Kryptos, and he did it with a computer attack. And then after he started getting public attention about that, then the CIA came up and they said, okay, well, we have one CIA operative here, or an analyst, who also solved those three parts, and he solved them in the previous year, but we didn't announce it publicly. And that man was David Stein, who did it all with pencil and paper. And then after the CIA mentioned about how they had David Stein, then the NSA came up and said, okay, well, we've got three people that have solved those first three parts as well, but we're not going to tell you who, and we're not going to tell you when, because that's very NSA, the no such agency people. All right. Now, when I was researching Kryptos, I found out that after Sanborn had created the Kryptos sculpture, he had made another sculpture, which he called the Untitled Kryptos Piece, which he sold to a private collector named Gilbert Kinney. And now Gilbert kept it on his balcony for a while, and then Gilbert moved and he donated the piece to the Hirshhorn Museum. And then the Neuberger Museum said that they wanted a version of it, and so Sanborn made another one, which is a little bit larger. And then both pieces kind of went through several hands. And the current location is that the original piece that belonged to Kinney is now in the home of a dot-com millionaire in Los Angeles, and the larger piece that was commissioned for the Neuberger Museum is now at the Hirshhorn Museum. So if you ever go to the Hirshhorn Museum, which is that big round museum that's near the Capitol building, right outside the front door of it, you can see the large version of the Untitled Kryptos piece. This is the one that's at the home of the dot-com millionaire in California. And it looks different from Kryptos, but on one side it has all of the text from Kryptos, though in a slightly different order. And on the other side of it, it has completely different text. It has encrypted Russian text. And the encrypted Russian text is what we just cracked a couple years ago. We figured out what that said. So here's, again, this is the piece that's at the Hirshhorn. And you can see that on one side you've got these kind of Latin, English language alphabet characters, and on the other side it's all encrypted Russian text. How am I doing on time, by the way? Okay. So, and now another thing we found is that the Russian text was duplicated on another of Sanborn's sculptures, which is called the Cyrillic Projector. So this text has about the top 75% of what's from the Untitled Kryptos piece. This piece was originally commissioned for some gallery art shows in the early 1990s, and then Sanborn sold it to the North Carolina, to the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, and that's where it stands right now. And it had not been solved in the time that it was there. So it talked to some of the students on campus, and they saw the characters. They didn't recognize them as Russian, and they thought, oh, well, maybe it's Greek, and it has something to do with the fraternities on campus or something. No one had cracked it. So now, differences between the crypto sculpture and the untitled piece. One is, this is a close-up of the untitled piece, and you can see that the letters here, we have E-N-D-Y-A-H-R, the Endy line. This is actually halfway down on the crypto sculpture. It's not the top part of the code. And also, here we have the visionaire table where we have these letters that are in diagonals. And these diagonals are, on the crypto sculpture, they're not the, it doesn't have the visionaire table over the ciphertext. It has the visionaire table on one side and then the ciphertext on the other side. So that's one difference between the two, that the untitled piece has one on top of the other. But even then, it starts with part three instead of starting with part one. Another difference is, and this again on the untitled Kryptos piece, is that way towards the bottom, this is about a foot off the ground. If you get up and look really close, there's these two dots. And these two dots do not appear on the CIA version of the sculpture anywhere. There may be some sort of a hint there. It may just be artistic license. The dots do also appear on the Hirshhorn version of the sculpture. Just intriguing little differences that we're researching while we're trying to figure out how to solve Kryptos. So the visionaire table, this is the crypto sculpture. We have the visionaire table on one side. And then there's also these reference alphabets, A through Z here, A through Z down this the margin here. And these two spaces, the reference spaces at top and bottom, which may or may not be applicable to the code, but we're definitely looking at everything that we can. There's also this pool at the bottom of the sculpture, and there's a pump that kind of pushes the water in a clockwise direction, as sort of like a vortex thing. And there's lots of speculation if that has anything to do with the code, or is it just to have a nice thing where you have water next to any public art piece? We don't know. So the visionaire table, the way it's constructed, is that there's a keyword which is Kryptos, and Kryptos is used to make this cipher alphabet, which is it's all 26 letters of the alphabet, but they're just in a different order. So we have the seven letters of Kryptos here, and then the rest of the alphabet, so A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, L, because the K was moved up here, M, N, Q, U, V, W, X, Z. So it's 26 letters, just in a different order. And that's one way to get kind of a scrambled cipher alphabet. And then if you take that cipher alphabet and then you put it in a tableau, you'll notice that you can read the word Kryptos here horizontally. You can also read the word Kryptos here vertically. And that's using just a single keyword system. Now, you could make it a little bit more difficult with a double keyword system. So then instead of the word Kryptos, like if you wanted to have the keyword apple, you could take this A and put it on the left-hand margin and then take this P on the left-hand. And you could spell the word apple down the left-hand margin, and then you would get this completely not exactly randomized, but you'd be getting a very different tableau, which you could use for the encryption. And that's exactly what was used for the first part of Kryptos. First part of Kryptos is these top two lines here, so EMUFPHZ and there. And here's the tableau here. So again, we have the Kryptos cipher alphabet, and then we have the keyword of palimpsest, which is read down this left-hand margin. And then you take the ciphertext, which is EMUFPHZ, and you put each letter on a different line. So EMUFPHZ. And then wherever it is, the E becomes a B. The M becomes an E. The U becomes a T. The F becomes a W, and on. So EMUFPHZ becomes BETWEEN, between. Right? And then you keep doing that, and you keep repeating palimpsest, and you can just build this tableau as long as necessary to solve the entire code. So using that system, there's the ciphertext, using the keywords of Kryptos and palimpsest. The plain text is, between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. Now, you notice it says occlusion, because there's a spelling error that is hard-coded right into the sculpture. Now, why? There's no such word as occlusion. And I asked Sanborn, I said, is that a mistake, or... what have you? He said, no, it's deliberate. But it's not what it is that's so important. It's where it is. It's the orientation or the positioning. Okay. All right. Don't know what that means, but it's very intriguing.
Has Sanborn written up why he did these and what did they really mean? And upon his death, they will be revealed or anything like that?
The question is, has Sanborn written this stuff up so that maybe upon his death, it'll all be revealed? He gets kind of cagey about some of this stuff. And he has said that when Kryptos was first dedicated, at the dedication ceremony, Sanborn, with great ceremony, handed over an envelope to William Webster, who was the head of the CIA at that time. And supposedly in that envelope was the answer of what the Kryptos codes say. Since then, Sanborn has said that he did not give the full answer to William Webster. He only gave him part of the answer in that envelope. But more recently, especially because Kryptos has been becoming so hugely famous lately, especially because of its link with the novel The Da Vinci Code, Sanborn has said that he has put the answers into safekeeping. Now, he hasn't really said what's going to happen to them on the event of his death. I think Sanborn kind of likes the idea that there might be an unsolved code that lasts for hundreds of years, with his name on it. So I don't think he's in any hurry to see it solved. But we're doing everything we can to persuade him. There's a type of cryptography which we have considered, which is called rubber hose cryptography, where you just beat the answer out of So it has crossed the minds of many of us, I'm sure. Okay, so here's the part two ciphertext, which starts at line 3 and goes all the way down to the bottom of the first plate. And the way that this actually came apart when David Stein solved it is, again, he noticed that there was this repeating pattern, DQM, DQM, and he made the speculation that maybe that was the word the. And he started from there. It's actually the and they, but, close enough, and that's kind of what pulled it open. And again, it used this double keyword system, so it was very tricky to solve. But in this case, the two keywords, instead of Kryptos and palimpsest, were Kryptos and abscissa. And it came out to say, it was totally invisible. How's that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field, X. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location, X. Does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere, X. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by rows, or maybe ID by row S. So the spelling error with underground is, again, Sanborn has said that one as well was deliberate, but it's not what it is, as where it is, that's the important part, the orientation or positioning. There's these X separators, we don't know what they mean. The latitude and longitude coordinates, anyone here who's played with GPSs or done geocaching, the 6.5 seconds north is particularly intriguing because a tenth of a second of latitude is a very specific location. It's about 10 feet across. So some people were speculating that this kind of pointed to the CIA and the crypto sculpture itself. It does point to the general location of CIA, but it doesn't point to the crypto sculpture. It points to a location about 150 feet southeast of the sculpture. Now, I have some people on CIA grounds that have gone and looked at that spot, And they say there's nothing unusual there. There's nothing engraved in the concrete. There's no manhole cover right at that spot, though there are manhole covers around the courtyard. And I'll have an overhead view of that in a sec. Now, some people have also wondered if maybe the sentence between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of occlusion. We were wondering if maybe it was a line from a poem or a play somewhere. And Sanborn said, no, this is an original sentence written by him with carefully chosen wording. So some people have speculated that maybe this is a hint for the key word of part two, which is abscissa. So subtle shading is SS, absence, ABS, light, C. And someone else also pointed out that abscissa has the letter CIA in it, so there might be some sort of a play on words there. We don't know. This is all just kind of speculation. I'm kind of sharing some of the thinking about the sculpture. All right, so now we have part three, which starts here at the top of this plate and goes all the way down to right about here or so. And we do have these little letters that are out of alignment. And when I showed this slide to Sanborn, he pointed at those letters and said, has anyone figured anything out about these? It's important. Don't know what that means. Have no idea what that means. But we've got lots of different theories about what they might mean. All right, so here we have the part three ciphertext. Now, some of you may notice that the ciphertext of this looks a little different than the ciphertext of the first two parts. Does anybody who hasn't been to my talk before, does anybody kind of see anything different about the ciphertext? Yeah, it looks more like real words, right? Because it's if you do a frequency.
I don't know if they're random, but I see the word hard and the word stew and the word here.
Mm-hmm. All right. The frequency of the letters here is much more like English than the others. The others, it was much more of a random distribution with all the letters of the alphabet. So you had lots of Q's and Z's and J's. And here, the most common letter is the letter E. And the second most common letter is T. And the most commonly used letters in the English language are E, T, A, O, I, N. And so this is using a different system. Instead of a substitution cipher, which was used for the first two parts, this is a transposition cipher. So all the letters of the message are right there. They're just scrambled. And so the thing to figure out is how they were scrambled and how to unscramble them. Now, when I was corresponding with Gary Warzen at the very beginning, before we'd set up the group, I came up with a pencil and paper method of how things might be unscrambled. And what I did is I put things in rows. Remember that first part that said ID by rows or ID by row S. So I put part three into these rows, and you get nice even rows. And anytime you get things like nice even patterns, that's really exciting. And then I started at the center here where we have this S. And then what I did is I started counting down by four. So if you count down from the S four, and you wrap around, you get an L. Count down another four, you get an O. You get to a W, you get to an L, you get to a Y. So S-L-O-W-L-Y, slowly. And then you keep doing that, and you get these wonderful, nice, clean diagonals. So again, that's something that gets cryptographers or code crackers really excited anytime you see a nice repeating pattern. And you start getting these words coming out of it that way. So slowly, desperately. And if you keep doing that, you can zip out the entire message using that method. So the plain text for part three comes out to say, slowly, desperately slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. Okay, again, not counting those who were at my talk yesterday. Who recognizes this? Tutankhamun. Very good. Very good. Yes, this is a paraphrased extract from the diary of Howard Carter on the November 26th, 1922, on the day that he discovered King Tut's tomb. It's not an exact word-for-word description, but it is obviously Howard Carter. The answer, by the way, to can you see anything, he answered was, yes, wonderful things, or yes, it is wonderful. Okay. So, and that brings us down to part four, and we have this question mark here. So there's debate about whether or not this question mark is part of part three. You know, can you see anything, Q? It would make sense for there to be a question mark there. Or is it part of part four? We don't know. But we have people who argue very, very forcefully on both sides of that particular discussion. All right. So now let me go on to the Cyrillic projector, which is the Russian that was on the other side of that untitled Cryptos piece. As I told you, it was created for the gallery shows. So it had not been cracked, and In 2003 was when I first started looking at it. And Randall Bullock, is Randall here, by the way? I know he's at the... Okay, he's over in the space track. Well, Randall was driving through North Carolina, and he decided to stop off at the campus, and he took a bunch of pictures of the sculpture, and he sent them along to me and said, hey, you know, maybe this will help. So I shared the pictures with the Kryptos group, and, okay, we need to transcribe this thing so that we can try and crack the code. And I didn't really hear anything for a couple weeks. I'm like, okay, I guess I got to transcribe it myself. So I sat for weeks with photographs of the sculpture spread all around me, and I'm writing these letters in Cyrillic. Some of them are backwards and working from all these different pictures, but finally made this entire transcript of the sculpture and presented it to the group saying, okay, here's a transcript, at which point two other people in the group popped up and said, oh, yeah, we have transcripts too. And I'm like, great, you know, thanks for telling me. But it was also good because this way we had three entirely independent transcripts which we could compare to make sure that we had one really accurate transcript. So we did that, and a little bit of work was done on the sculpture, but nobody really made any serious progress. So I said, okay, well, let's go public with the transcript. So I made a web page, put it out there for the world to see and say, well, maybe someone else will figure something else out that we didn't. Well, somebody did, and I'm not sure if I have the whole story here, but someone sent an anonymous letter to my customer service department at my game company saying that they had solved the Cyrillic projector, but they didn't say what the answer to it was. They just said that they'd solved it. So that was kind of confusing for a while because I wasn't sure, what do you do when someone says that they've solved a code, but they haven't given any proof that they've solved it? And so I talked to Jim Gologlu, who was the head of the American Cryptogram Association, and he said that this has come up in the past and that the general feeling in the crypy community is that you don't get credit for solving something unless you prove that you've solved it, meaning that you have to show what the plain text is, what the method was that was used to derive that plain text, and it needs to be duplicatable by someone else, which is basic scientific method. Something isn't proven unless a third-party independent laboratory can duplicate whatever the process was. And so I took the letter and I filed it away. And then a couple months later, the guy who wrote that letter decided that he was going to give me some other clue. And that was when I kind of went through my weblogs. And I like seeing who links to me all the time, and I read my weblogs every day. And I was reading, and I saw that I had a link from the site, which is cpsolution.htm. And I thought, wow, what an intriguing URL. And I went and I tracked it down. And what it was is that the guy who had sent me the anonymous letter had decided to make this single web page. And what his plan was that he was going to make this web page and he was going to put it out on the web and then see if I maybe ran across it accidentally through Google. But what he didn't know is that as soon as he put this link to my site on his page, boom, it showed up in my weblogs immediately. And we tracked him down within 24 hours of him making the page. Yeah. So, I've kind of X'd out his name here, but we tracked him down really fast and got his email address and wrote to him and said, hey, you know, congratulations. And he said that he had figured out a way to get some recognizable Russian text out of it, but he couldn't read Russian, and it was all kind of mushed together, and it had lots of spelling errors, so he still didn't entirely know what it said. So I stayed up really late one night, and then the next day it was like this really horrible Saturday for me because I was working really hard on this code, but at the same time it was a Saturday and I promised some friends that I was going to help them move, and I was like, okay, crack this really famous, internationally famous code or carry boxes, and I ended up doing both, and I was carrying boxes and working the cell phone, and it was a very dramatic day, and the battery was running low and I had to keep going out in the front yard to get a good signal, but by the end of the day we'd moved all the boxes and we finally knew what it said. I tracked down someone, a friend of a friend who is an engineer from the ex-Soviet Union who was a native speaker of Russian, the Russian language, and through him and my father and some other people, we were finally able to figure out what it said. So does anyone here speak Russian or can read Russian? Okay. Okay. So feel free to verify by looking at this. Because it's all mushed together, I know that it's very, very difficult to read. This is an example. This isn't what it says, but this is an example of the problem in English, which is, this sentence might be easily understandable to a native English speaker, but someone not familiar with English would have a great deal of trouble reading or translating it. Plus the fact that there isn't any punctuation isn't any help either. No. So this is what the Russian was like, all mushed together, lots of spelling errors, and we really needed a native speaker. Yeah, it's interesting that you saw that. Medusa was a word that kind of showed up as in the projection of the Cyrillic projector, and Medusa was one of the keywords for solving it. It turned out to be a two-keyword system, and there were some other twists that made it difficult. It used a different variation of the Russian alphabet, where some of the letters were not in the same order that they usually are. And the keywords, one keyword was the word, it's like Tien, which is like T-E-H, and then a lowercase b, which means darkness or shadow. And the other keyword was Medusa, but it wasn't spelled M-E-D-U-S-A. It was spelled in Cyrillic, which is sort of like M-E-D-Y-3-A. And those two keywords led to it. So the translation that we came up with, and I don't know if you want to read or verify any of this, but once all the words are kind of separated out, this is what it came out to be. And I won't read this entire thing to you, but it came out to be extracts of two different types of text. And the first one was instructions to Secret Service agents about how to develop a source and how you want to psychologically control that source of information. You want to weave a net around them. Because if you need information from them, you can pull that net tight. And if you can control someone psychologically, then you know that you can trust the information that you're getting from them. So it's really kind of a chilling instruction manual here. And then the second part of it was an extract from a classified KGB memo, which is concerns about a Soviet dissident named Sakharov, who was going to be speaking at the Pugwash conference in the early 1980s. And this was concerns that the KGB had that his comments were going to be used at the Pugwash conference and used by the Americans for an anti-Soviet agenda. And I say it's classified KGB correspondence, and how do I know it's classified? Well, we found the source document of this and the actual memo that that second part came from. And this letter was actually tucked into a folder in the Smithsonian when I was doing my research on Sanborn and making a list of the different sculptures that he'd done. And I asked the Smithsonian to send me everything they had on Sanborn, and they sent me this big stack of folders. And in this big stack of folders was this classified KGB memo. And as it turns out, it was the source document for part of the Cyrillic projector. So here it says, like, Sakharov. And I know it's classified because up at the top it said Sekretno, secret. So when the code was solved, and then we did a press release about it, and all hell broke loose on my website, I went from getting like 10 hits an hour to like 9,000 hits an hour, which is what happens when a news article goes up on Slashdot. And then in the Slashdot message boards, there were some jokes about the projector saying, no, what the Cyrillic projector really says is send more vodka. And then someone else said, no, what the Cyrillic projector really says is keep information away from moose and squirrel. And I really like that. I got a good laugh out of that. So after we'd solved it, we went back and we looked at the projector, and we went and looked at the spelling errors to see, were the spelling errors something that was actually on the sculpture, or had we just screwed up in our transcript? And it turns out that they were actually on the sculpture. So we don't know if these spelling errors are maybe going to give us clues towards solving Kryptos now, or were they just mistakes by Sanborn or by one of Sanborn's assistants? Because, again, encrypting things is very difficult. Errors creep into the process very, very quickly and very, very easily. And especially when you're dealing with a different language, in a language that's using a different alphabet, I can see that would be extremely error-prone.
Have I had a chance to ask Sanborn if those were
intentional? The question was, have I had a chance to ask Sanborn if those were intentional? Yes, and he... When I mentioned all the errors, and he went something like, "Ah, Lindy," you know, and I got the impression that he meant that that was one of his assistants, and he was kind of blaming it on one of his assistants. And Lindy was not the name. I'm changing the name of what he said, but that was the impression I got from him, that it was just a screw up. But he also gets really cryptic, and he's said on air at times when he's been interviewed that deception and misdirection is part of the whole thing. And so
thus
I.
Thus might Lindy be the same.
Sorry?
And thus might Lindy be the same.
With the deception.
And misdirection.
Right. So my gut tells me that it was just a mistake. That Sanborn said, here's this text, encrypt this text with these keywords, and the assistant came back and gave him the ciphertext, and Sanborn just took it without checking it. That's my gut feeling, but I don't know for sure. The question is, are all the errors just on this one side? No. This is just this one slide where I'm showing these errors. They were pretty evenly scattered. And some of them were, I don't know if you've ever messed with Cyrillic, but some of the letters are very similar. Like these two letters down here, one is like a backwards N, and one is a backwards N that has a little squiggle over the top of it. And some of the errors that we saw were those kinds of errors where, like here's another character where you've got this kind of... three-prong trident, which has a little squiggle down here at the bottom. And there's another one, which is this three-prong trident, which has no squiggle. So some of the spelling errors were like that, where someone may have just missed the little tail on it. But others were completely different letters. So it's some of them I can say, yeah, that was definitely human error, but others I don't know. I just don't know. Okay. So here's the crypto sculpture again at CIA headquarters. I did finally wangle an invitation to CIA to speak about Al-Qaeda codes, and so that's when I got a chance to get some rubbings of the sculpture, and I made my webpage about it. So the latitude and longitude here. And again, I need another time check. How are we doing on time? Okay, thanks. So this is an overhead view of CIA headquarters. This is the old headquarters building here. And then they commissioned the new headquarters building, which is on this side. This building with the funny-shaped roof in the middle, this is the cafeteria. And there's a, you can't see it in this picture, but there's a bank of windows on this side of the cafeteria. So as the employees are sitting in the cafeteria, they can look out over this courtyard. And the crypto sculpture is right in this little corner of the courtyard. And Sanborn designed the crypto sculpture. He also designed a big chunk of this courtyard, and he designed some pieces that are here near the entrance to the new headquarters building. Here's a close-up here. So again, we have the cafeteria here. And the crypto sculpture is right here. And Sanborn designed this entire green semicircular area. We have a duck pond here. And there's some large slabs of granite with sandwich sheets of copper that are lining this walkway here. Now, when I showed this slide to Sanborn and I said, okay, we think, here's the crypto sculpture, and we think that the latitude and longitude coordinates point to right about here. And he nodded and he said, yeah, that's about right. It's either there or here. Right. So now why, I don't know. It's now the slabs, there's three slabs, and one of them is kind of here, and one is here, and one is here. So it's possible that there's like a line that's being drawn by the slabs, and I'll have a close-up of some of the slabs here. We don't have a whole lot of pictures of them. We've also wondered if maybe we need to take the latitude and longitude coordinate and the sculpture and draw a line, and then take the slabs and draw a line and maybe look at the intersection point there. But I don't have a whole lot of contacts on CIA grounds that can go look at these, lift up the rock, look behind the door, and go dig here. And they can't really do that without getting kicked out of their jobs. So there's a limit to how much information we can get. But I've got this big list of questions on my website saying, if you have access to CIA, can you go check this? Which way does this point? Where is this? Can you measure this? How thick is the sheet of copper over here? And which way does this oriented it over in this direction? And bit by bit, we're getting little trickles of information. Right. So this is some of the granite slabs here. This is about a foot thick. And we have these sheets of copper. And in the copper, we have these Morse code messages. And the messages say things like SOS, T is your position, shadow forces, lucid memory, digital interpretatu. And some of it, like digital interpretatu, that's kind of, maybe it's supposed to be interpretation. And again, and it kind of disappears under the rock. So T is your position. The T is right next to one of the slabs here. So it might actually say, like, what is your position? And we're not seeing the entire word. There's also a compass rose near some of the Morse code messages. Now, we know that the compass rose, the north on the compass, is not pointing north, true north, and we know that the needle on the compass rose is not pointing towards true north. We've had some people sort of describe saying, well, it sort of points this way, and so we've kind of been speculating on some things there, but we haven't gotten the exact measurement of which way the compass points. I did find that Sanborn made two other sculptures that also use compass roses, and they're also in the Washington, D.C. area. One is in Maryland and one is in Virginia. And we've tried doing things like taking all three compass roses and trying to see which way they point, but we haven't discovered anything unusual there. So it might be coincidence, it might be a clue, we don't know. Artery Plaza. Mm-hmm. It's next to the one that's hidden under the three events. Okay.
Maybe if you work out the latitude and longitude directions, what there would be if that compass was pointing.
And that's a really good idea. Figure out the latitude and longitude based on which way that the compass is pointing. And we've had some people doing that and kind of shifting latitude and longitude. We also had somebody do something really interesting with the magnetic field and seeing where the magnetic variations were on where the compass would be pointing and trying to see if things could shift that way. So we have lots of interesting points, which are points of interest, but there's nothing there, or maybe we need to dig, or maybe it's not what it points to. Like maybe the crypto sculpture is one point, and maybe the compass is a second point, and the latitude and longitude is a third point, and maybe we need to draw a rectangle, and what we need to find is at the fourth point. And there's nothing there, but it might be some variation on this. We don't know. There's just so many different possibilities.
But it could be in the fourth part.
It could be
in the fourth part of this sculpture.
The fourth part of the sculpture might have something to do with the fourth point, absolutely. Sanborn has said that even after part four is solved, there is still a greater mystery that remains after that. So there's going to be some larger kind of meta puzzle. Sanborn really likes the idea. Sanborn has said that if you know everything there is to know about a piece of art, then it's not a very interesting piece of art. And the question is, who is WW? Who knows the exact location, only WW? We had a lot of speculation about that, but Sanborn finally confirmed it earlier this year that WW is indeed William Webster, who was the director of the CIA at the time that the sculpture was installed. Okay. So these are, I'll go through these really briefly. These are some other methods of solving part three. Someone figured out that part three, there's a numeric key, which is 1473625. And then David Allen Wilson of North Carolina said, oh, well, 1473625 is the word cryptos, which is a real exciting discovery because we knew that cryptos was a keyword for part one. We knew it was a keyword for part two, but we'd never figured out a way that cryptos was a keyword for part three. And when he said cryptos is 1473625, we're like, how is that? And he says, well, what you do is you take the word cryptos and you alphabetize the letters in cryptos and then you number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then when you spell it correctly again you get the number 1, 4, 7, 3, 6, 2, 5. So now cryptos is a keyword for part three, which means it's a pretty safe bet that cryptos is going to be a keyword for part four as well. Probably, maybe, don't know. It's possible. And this was the very first way that part three was solved was through this mathematical system in the computer attacks, where if you start here with the E and make that letter number 1, 2, 3, and you count to the 192nd letter, it's an S, and from there you count another 192nd letter, you get to the L, count to the next 192nd letter, you get to the O, and that's another way, S-L-O-W-L-Y, of pulling out the message. And double columnar transposition, and then here we have the out-of-alignment letters, and I told you that Sanborn said that this is important. Somebody else pointed out that on the visionaire tableau side, that there was this extra L, which is this final, on the right-hand margin, it should be the same here, E-F-G-H-I-J-L-M-N, and it goes E-F-G-H-I-L-L. So there's these two Ls. This line should end with the J, but it ends with the L. It's also interesting to note that this line where the extra L appears is the same line on the other side of the sculpture where those letters are out of alignment, the Y-A-R. So it may be deliberate on the part of the artist as a way of drawing the eye to that line. Yeah, Lorraine.
You thought about the fact that the misspelled word that you thought should have been illusion is missing an L, a double L.
Right, that's a good point. Lorraine mentions that the misspelled word occlusion is missing an L, and here we have an extra L, and that may indeed have something to do with it. Sorry? Are we missing any cues? No. Though one interesting thing, though, is that to make that cue, whatever letter was there was replaced with a different letter, and the word that made occlusion and the word that made underground. And the letter that was stamped into the sculpture to make that cue was a K. And the letter that was stamped into the sculpture to make the extra U in underground was an R, which are the first two letters of the word cryptos. The K is what the L is.
Yes, there should be a K there, H-I-J-K.
Well, no, actually, it could be. I mean, yeah, you know, a K is between J and L, and it's a valid observation. Yep, true. Okay. And then we counted the number of characters on either side of the sculpture, and we had 869 characters on one side and 866 on the other. And then we added in the missing L, and we had, okay, 867. Kind of interesting, and I just thought, okay, yeah, that's nice trivia. And then then John Wilson here kind of pointed out, well, what about those two reference spaces where the alphabets are? And if you add those two in, then all of a sudden it's 869 and 869. It's the exact same number of characters on either side of the sculpture. And suddenly these numbers become much more interesting. When I showed this slide to Ed Scheidt about the 869, he didn't say anything, but he was sitting in the back and he was nodding. So I don't know if he was nodding to be encouraging, like, yes, you're discovering all the extra little bits of trivia, or if this is something that's important that we need to figure out. I have no idea. Right. Told you about that, spelling errors. Something else that John knows, when he went to the Cyrillic projector, and as you pointed out about how the word Medusa shows up, this word Medusa is an English version of one of the keywords, and it's on the third line of the sculpture here so that the light can project it out onto the wall there. Well, when John went up and took a close look at the sculpture, he saw that on that third line there's an extra bolt in the sculpture right there. And it's a little bit difficult to see here, but if you look at it from the inside, it's really obvious. There's an extra bolt sticking out. And it is the only extra bolt like that in the entire sculpture. So it's plausible that Sanborn put that bolt there to draw the eye to that line. So that may have something to do with the extra L that's on Kryptos, or those characters that are a little bit out of alignment. We would love to get in and take a closer look at the sculpture. I mean, I am one of the world's top experts on the Kryptos sculpture, and I've only seen the thing once. Everything else, we've got like a few pictures here and there, and I've contacted CIA Public Affairs and their media relations, and I've begged them, saying, can we please have more pictures? I mean, not right away. Take your time. I'll pay for them. Can I get my congressman to write to you and request the pictures? And they just say, no. They say, you can use what's on our website. We're not making any more pictures. And I'm like, this is paid for with public money. I'm going to get more pictures of these sculptures. So it's
you gotta declare it under the Freedom of Information.
Freedom of Information Act. I mean, I've been writing to the General Services Administration. I've tried the National Endowment for the Arts, and I've written to them, and I've all kinds of different people. Another question way in the back.
Yeah, do you think it's because that they actually have people like the CIA who are working on it as well, and they just don't want anybody else to kind of do it before they do?
The question is it possible that they're not giving out pictures because they have someone else at the CIA that's working on it, and they're trying to kind of keep the cards close to their vest? I don't think so. I think that they're just... they don't want to be releasing pictures of CIA because it's a security hazard, or they've got procedures saying that we should not be handing out photographs of what our buildings look like. In the media department, there's a woman named Molly Hale, or at least that's the name that she goes by. And so anytime you write to CIA and say, can I have a tour? And you get an answer, no. It's going to be signed, a letter that's going to be signed by Molly Hale. And I think that they just get correspondence and questions constantly. And I can say from firsthand experience with my website, the majority of the correspondence that I get about the sculpture is from people who are crazy, flat-out schizophrenics. They write to me and they say, I've solved Kryptos and it's proof that the space aliens are coming. I've solved Kryptos and it means you have to draw a line between Angkor Wat and Mars. And that's the majority of the correspondence I get. And I'm just this little one person with my one webpage. I imagine the CIA, which is a much more imagination-sparking agency, probably gets crazies writing to them dozens of times a day. And so they just have set procedures saying, no, they ask for this, we're going to say no. And here I am, in my opinion, a legitimate sane person, in my opinion, writing to them or calling them and saying, can I please have a picture? And they have no way of knowing that I'm legit. And so I just get the standard no answer, the same as anybody else would. But that doesn't mean I'm going to give up. Have I considered applying for employment? Actually, yeah, when I do these talks, I've written to some of my contacts at CIA saying, okay, I'm about to do a talk at a fan convention. I'm going to have overhead views of CIA headquarters, and I'm going to be showing pictures of the front entrance. Is this okay? I don't want guys in suits to be showing up and dragging me out. And the answer I've gotten back is, Ilanka, you are a private citizen. You can say anything the heck you want. The people who work at CIA would not be allowed to show these slides, okay? So, and people also ask me if I want to get a job working as a cryptographer or work for the NSA or work for the CIA. And my attitude on that is really, it's more fun as a hobby. If I had to do it as a job, it wouldn't be as cool. And this way I have just this enormous coolness factor that's involved with it.
And then there's that scene from that Matt Damon movie where
Matt Damon movie.
Oh, yeah. He beat Cod in Quaker State.
Yeah,
big scene where he says why he doesn't want to work for the NSA.
Oh, yeah, Good Will Hunting.
Oh, in Good Will Hunting, he said why he didn't want to.
If you go read that scene, look it up in Internet Movie Database.
Okay.
The scripts are online. Read that monologue because it was done like 15 years
ago. Okay.
And it's prophetic.
Oh, yeah, Good Will Hunting is great writing. Absolutely wonderful writing. Okay, so here's a slide, again, where I was just kind of showing those reference spaces. And this is one of my pet theories about solving Kryptos, is that the reason it's this kind of curvy thing is that it's actually two parts of a cylinder, which would be very similar to a system that Thomas Jefferson came up with. And so we have American Code, History of Cryptography, where he had these different disks, and you could order the disks and then in different patterns, and then you would line up a ciphertext line, and then you would read the plain text. So it's possible that each line of text is supposed to be a different disk, and we just need to figure out what order to put the disks in. But anyway, it's just a pet theory there. Something else that was noticed about part four here is that we do have the letters KR YP and TOS all right next to each other here. So Kryptos is spelled. And any place we start seeing the word Kryptos or KR or anything like that, it kind of perks us up. It might be a coincidence, might not. When we line things up in these nice seven-letter rows, and again, Kryptos has seven letters in it, when we count the doubled letters, the doubled letter pairs, there's six doubled letter pairs in part four. Five of them are directly underneath each other. They're all in these same columns. And this is the chances of there being six doubled letter pairs. Someone, I think it was Ferdinando, worked it out. The chances were like 1 in 3 that there would be six doubled letter pairs, which really isn't that exciting. It's just a roll of the dice. But the chances of five of them being lined up like that, it's like chances are like 1 in 1,000. So that's what we call statistically significant. It hasn't really led us anywhere, but the fact that it's seven character rows, it's another one of the intriguing phenomena. This is a picture of Ed Scheidt, and he was called the Wizard of Codes by William Webster. He's currently working at a security company in Virginia. And, for example, one of the Star Wars movies that the digital version was being beamed around the country, his company was in charge of the security for that as the bits and bytes were being scooted around. He also really loves anything to do with Egypt. He wears ties with hieroglyphic patterns. Not in this particular photo, but all through his office, I saw Egyptian stuff in his office. And he said that he figured the last part of Kryptos would probably stand for 10 years before it was cracked. He said, I saved the best for last. Also, when David Stein, who was the first person on CIA grounds to solve it, he gave a talk about how he'd done it. And at the end of the talk, Ed Scheidt went up to him and said, congratulations, you did indeed solve those first three parts, but not in the way that I intended them to be solved. And when I spoke to Scheidt at an art show opening, one of Sanborn's art shows, about it, he says, well, you've solved the first three parts, but you did it without recovering the keys first. You need to recover the keys. And we have just been beating our heads on that statement. What the heck does that mean? Sanborn has also said that there are clues in plain sight that everyone has missed. And we don't know what that means either. We know what the keys are for part one, two, abscissa, palimpsest, Kryptos, the transposition cipher. We haven't seen the word abscissa anywhere around the sculpture. We haven't seen the word palimpsest. We could anagram the Morse code. We've tried reading the Morse code forwards and backwards. So I don't know if we're finally going to find it out. We're going to go, dope, and that's what it was. Or if there is something really cryptic and very difficult in there. Yeah. So. Okay. We may be missing something because we can't get in there. That's possible. I mean, Sanborn is currently working on a miniature version of Kryptos to offer for sale, and he was asking me how much money that he thought he could get for it, for a little 6-inch, 10-inch high version. And my first question to him was, will it have all relevant details that are on the actual sculpture at CIA? And he kind of hemmed and hawed a little bit, and he said, well, I carved the CIA version by hand, and that would be very difficult to duplicate on a small piece. I'm like, that's a real interesting thing for him to say, that he carved it by. So what does that mean? That there are maybe like little, he carved certain letters with a rougher pattern than others, and if we find those, that maybe there will be spelling something out in Morse code on the sculpture, and that's where the keys came from. And I would love to get in there with a magnifying glass and like a spectrometer and just measure the heck out of the thing. I mean, really observe it. So now Ed Scheidt, when I was talking to him, one of the things that he was really wanted to see is he wanted to see me get back onto CIA grounds. He said, when are you going to get up back on, when are you going to get back to see Kryptos again? And I thought it was very interesting that he kept saying that about when was I going to be able to get in there to see it personally again. And so he may have been making some sort of a hint that was required to get in there. And I told him that I was going to try, but it was really difficult to get an invite to onto CIA headquarters. He said, well, do what you can, and if you can't, let me know. So I tried, and I tried pulling all kinds of strings, and all the strings broke. And so I finally wrote to him on December 11th, 2003, and I said, I've tried everything I can. I can't get on grounds. You said maybe you could do something to pull strings and get me on site. Well, I didn't hear back from him right away, but about 2 to 3 hours after I sent that message, I get this IM that pops up on my screen from a Molly H. And it has one line. It says, the key to Kryptos is Komitet. Okay, is this one of the crazies, or is this somebody, is this real? I had no idea who it was, so I kind of sent a message back saying, tell me more, and I didn't get a reply, but they were still online. You can tell when someone's logged off. And then they didn't say anything, and a few minutes later, I sent another message, and they disappeared. And so I kind of reach out to my friends in the hacker tech scene. I'm like, who the heck is Molly H? And they went and checked, and they said, this is one of the AOL accounts that was hacked with a hack that's been going around recently. Someone used it. They sent you one-line message, and then they deleted it. So, okay, all right. Now, Comitet is the K in KGB. It was something that jumped out to me, but most people wouldn't be aware of that. It's KGB stands for the Committee of State Security, Komitet Gosudarstvenoy Bezopashnosti. And Molly Hale, as I mentioned before, is the head of the CIA's Public Affairs Department. So it was interesting that they chose this name of Molly H. It was also interesting that they used the word key and not keyword. Ed Scheidt kept saying, you haven't recovered the keys yet. You have to recover the keys. And also, Comitet has seven letters, which is also something very intriguing. And here's that document that was in the Smithsonian folders, and there we have the word Comitet. So was it a hint or a hoax? I don't know, but it's intriguing enough that I wanted to share it here as in the presentation. No matter what, whoever sent the IM, number one, they knew I was working on Kryptos. That's not difficult. You go to Google, you type in Kryptos, my name pops up. Maybe they knew some stuff about CIA with Molly Hale. Maybe they knew some crypto terminology that they knew to say key and not keyword. Maybe they knew some Cold War history, because the word Comitet is not commonly known. And they knew to send a seven-letter key, and no matter what, they knew how to cover their tracks. So hint or hoax, no idea. There was a question over here.
I'm just curious if there's any significance, you know, the K for Kryptos instead of using a C, being more standard English.
Kryptos is a Greek word which means hidden, and it's actually spelled correctly with the K. Now, Scott, do I need to be wrapping up, or shall I just keep going here?
You need to be wrapping up. Was there anything on the linear A and B we're going to talk about in addition?
Just the Phaistos disk, just a little bit that I mentioned there. So, I've got a CNN segment. I got a little an NPR segment I can play, but I should probably be wrapping it up soon. This is the Zola Spy Restaurant in Washington D.C. and Sanborn designed this restaurant, and he put a bunch of classified documents on the wall. One of these documents is the source document for the Cyrillic projector. So it's possible that one of these documents might also be a source document for Kryptos. Let me see. So summary, there are many world-famous unsolved codes. Many of them may have been hoaxes or just plain are not solvable, which is why it's been so long that they haven't been solved. But some are solvable, and over 100 years, like the Edgar Allan Poe stuff, were indeed solved after 100 years of trying. Code makers make mistakes. That's the number one thing that I notice. And many codes that I have cracked, I've cracked not because I have this brilliant cryptanalytic mind, but that I would look at it and say, okay, it hasn't been solved. It was written by a human. They probably screwed up. If they were going to screw up, how would they have screwed up? And then I look for the mistakes that they were most likely to make, and then I start getting plain text out of it. And then I can zip out the rest of the message. So it wasn't that I knew cryptography. It's that I knew humans. Right. Many codes are solved by looking for small patterns. Several codes by finding the three-letter repeating patterns, like the. So if you're trying to work on a code, look for any little thing, and it may be what cracks it open. But the important thing is to try and to share information, to get as many different people working on it as possible. If you want more information, you can type famous unsolved codes at Google. You can send me an IM. My screen name is Ilanka. If you want to read about codes, the number one book I recommend is by Simon Singh. It's called The Code Book. It's a very good general read. Pretty much anyone can understand it. If you want to dig a little bit deeper, I recommend one by David Kahn called The Code Breakers, which has an extensive information about all kinds of different codes. And here's that list again of the famous unsolved codes. And were there any other questions?
I missed the first half because I was engaged in some sort of a violent altercation on the street.
In fact, there is another cipher challenge if anybody is interested.
Could you tell me briefly if you had any comment on the Voynich manuscript or the Beale cipher? Are they solvable?
I think my belief is that the Beale ciphers are a hoax. It was an urban legend designed to sell pamphlets, and the Voynich manuscript, I lean towards the hoax. I lean towards the hoax theory.
Yeah. What special challenges do you think lost languages like Rongo Rongo and Etruscan have compared to ciphers?
I think the Rongo Rongo script, and that's the one off of Easter Island, I think is going to be really, really difficult to solve because we have such a small sample of it. We only have a very few tablets that are left over. I think the Etruscan script, I think there's a chance that that will be solved because we simply have thousands of different items that have that script on it. The reason I include them on this list is because anytime you talk to a cryptographer about famous unsolved codes, some of these old languages are going to pop up. You know, that hasn't been solved. And it's sort of like a code figuring out an old language. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.